Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening.
Beautiful. My name is Professor Jonathan L. Walton. I am the Plummer Professor of Christian Morals and the Pusey Minister here in the Memorial Church. And it is a true pleasure to welcome you all here tonight to the 2014 Paul Tillich Lecture. The intent of this lecture series is to honor and extend the legacy of arguably one of the most influential theologians and philosophers of the 20th century. Thus, the Paul Tillich Lecture seeks to bring leading thinkers to campus to explore the intersections of theology and modern culture, as well as wrestle with the existential questions of human existence and ultimate concern. I contend that this lecture series has lived up to this ideal ever since it was introduced in 1990 from the office of the University Marshal under then University Marshal Dr. Richard Hunt. And alongside the intellectual and professional prominence of past Paul Tillich lecturers, such as the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Massachusetts Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, Professor Letty Russell, and most recently Robert Bella, there is another reason that this particular lecture series has become one of the more successful annual events on this campus. It has to do with the tireless efforts and organizational acumen of a Mr. William R. Kraut. For nearly a quarter of a century, he has dedicated his life to ensuring that the legacy of Paul Tillich remains central to the intellectual conversations taking place on this campus at the intersection of theology, philosophy, faith, and values. Therefore, I think it's only right that we continue to honor his legacy, that he has left this university, and that we pray will continue forward in perpetuity. We thank you, Mr. Kraut, for your service and your commitment to this lecture series, as you have dug a well on this campus from which we pray generations yet to be born will find intellectual sustenance in this, the Paul Tillich Lecture Series. And now, I would like to bring forth Professor Kevin J. Madigan, the Wynn Professor of Ecclesiastical History and Associate Dean of the Faculty and Academic Affairs at Harvard Divinity School, to introduce tonight's, once again, extending this great tradition of having the best and brightest minds give the Paul Tillich Lecture. Please receive Professor Kevin Madigan.
Jonathan, thank you for giving me the honor of introducing tonight's Tillich Lecture. It is indeed a pleasure, a genuine pleasure, to introduce tonight's lecturer, who is an award-winning author, an historian, a novelist, and a local hero as a columnist for the Boston Globe, as well as an honored friend. Jim Carroll is author of 10 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. These works of nonfiction include An American Requiem, a brilliant memoir, which I'm sure many of you have read, that won the National Book Award, a piece of work that seamlessly merged the familial and the national. He also wrote the New York Times best-selling Constantine's Sword, which is a magisterial 2,000-year history of interaction between Jews and Christians, and which has been made into a documentary. House of War, which won the first Penn Galbraith Award. And Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World, which was named a 2011 Best Book by Publishers Weekly. Recently, his Boston Globe columns were honored with the 2012 Scripps Award for Best Commentary. Jim also writes quite regularly for the New York Magazine. Among the classics, which I commend to you in that journal, in that magazine, are an article called The Silence on Pope Pius XII during the Second World War, and much more recently, one that you may have seen, a terrific profile of Pope Francis I in the Christmas Day number of that magazine. Jim lectures widely, both in the United States and abroad. In 2014, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt will publish his 11th novel, Warburg in Rome, and Viking in November will publish Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age, his 8th work of nonfiction. Now, in blurbing a recent book by a mutual friend, Jim declared that this author, this mutual friend, wrote, quote, history for the sake of justice. And I think that applies to Jim as well. Everything Jim does and all he does really is for the sake of justice. And it's only appropriate, therefore, that we honor him tonight as Harvard's 2014 Tillich Lecturer. Please join me, therefore, in welcoming James Carroll as he addresses us on the topic, Tillich, Bonhoeffer, and the Future of Jesus Christ. Jim?
So, before I speak, I want to say something, which is how deeply touched I am by your introduction, Kevin, by your welcome, Professor Walton, the deep honor I feel to be a Tillich lecturer. I want to acknowledge my most of 20-year debt now to the Harvard Divinity School, and in particular to David Hempton. And I want to also acknowledge at the outset two giants on whose shoulders I have stood for most of my life, Christopher Stendahl and Harvey Cox. I also want to begin by just taking in the power for me personally to stand in this place, in this sacred space, which has been a touchstone of my life for 45 years. And finally, it's all too rare that I have the opportunity to acknowledge the ever deeper debt I feel to my wife, Alexandra Marshall. So I seize the opportunity to acknowledge her this evening with gratitude. In Germany, early in 1943, things got serious with Operation Spark, the anti-Nazi conspiracy to assassinate Adolf Hitler. In March, two bomb attempts were made on Hitler's life. They failed. But in early April, numerous of the conspirators were arrested by the Gestapo. One of these was a young Lutheran theologian named Dietrich Bonhoeffer. For 2 years he was imprisoned, first at Tegel Military Prison in Berlin, ultimately at Buchenwald and Flossenbürg concentration camps. A committed pacifist engaged in a plot to murder a tyrant, he wrote, "The ultimate question for a responsible man to ask is not how he is to extricate himself heroically from the affair, but how the coming generation shall continue to live." Bonhoeffer was hanged 3 weeks before the war ended, before the full horrors of 1945 were laid bare. Yet there is a hint in his statement that in the thick of the evil, he had grasped what was now at stake, nothing less than the moral self-destruction and perhaps the physical self-extinction of the human species, its continuing to live. Bonhoeffer did not survive to articulate the meaning of what he had come to. But in subsequent years, fragments of thought he left flashed through the Christian theology like crystal shards through a darkened conscience. And that was especially so once Auschwitz was paired with Hiroshima. Absolute evil, absolutely armed. The death camp and the genocidal weapon all at once bracketing the human future. The mad nuclear competition that followed then made the problem of human survival literal. A year before his death, initiating a project for belief that has yet to be accomplished, Bonhoeffer declared himself in a letter to his student and friend Eberhard Bethge, who was himself in 1993 a Tillich lecturer here. "What is bothering me incessantly," he wrote, "is the question who Christ actually is for us today." That line, written in a Nazi cell, is a shorthand proclamation of Bonhoeffer's penetration to the deepest question about the human condition, which raised for a serious Christian an equally grave question about Jesus Christ and the tradition that takes its name from him. Tectonic shifts in culture, religion, politics, and structures of thought cracked the foundations of Christ's meaning, even if Christian believers have yet to fully reckon with that mutation. And among the many factors that have contributed to that dislocation, none looms larger than the still deflected moral catastrophe faced directly by Bonhoeffer. He was a first witness to the apocalyptic fervor of the Third Reich, the millennial character of the crisis, and the fact that Christendom, a culture in place since Charlemagne, and nearly the sole context within which Jesus Christ had been understood, was mortally undermined by racist Nazi imperialism. And Bonhoeffer was a first to grasp how the ethical shattering of Christendom extended to the keystone of Christian faith, to Jesus himself. It falls to us to confront far more directly than Bonhoeffer could what precisely has happened. Auschwitz and Hiroshima changed everything To paraphrase Albert Einstein, accept human ways of thinking and believing. Here, familiar to you, is Bonhoeffer's full statement to Bethge. Quote, "You would be surprised, and perhaps even worried, by my theological thoughts and the conclusions that they lead to. What is bothering me incessantly is the question, what Christianity is, or indeed, who Christ actually is for us today. The time when people could be told everything by means of words, whether theological or pious, is over. And so is the time of inwardness and conscience, and that means the time of religion in general. We are moving toward a completely religionless time. People as they are now simply cannot be religious anymore. Even those who honestly describe themselves as religious do not in the least act up to it, and so they presumably mean something quite different by religion. If our final judgment must be that the Western form of Christianity, too, was only a preliminary stage to the complete absence of religion, what kind of situation emerges for us, the Church? How can Christ be the Lord of the religionless as well? The question to be answered surely would be, what do a church, a community, a sermon, a liturgy, a Christian life mean in a religionless world? How do we speak of God without religion? Christ is no longer an object of religion, but something quite different, really the Lord of the world. But what does that mean? What is the place of worship and prayer in a religionless situation? I hope you see more or less what I mean, and I hope it doesn't bore you. Goodbye for the present. I am thinking of you very much. Your Dietrich." Bonhoeffer's sketchy intuitions, offered most significantly in his letters and papers from prison, read like picture captions. But the picture he holds up shows the deep truth of an unprecedented circumstance. It is clear from the passage just cited that the traumatized German was groping to express what remained an unspeakable experience. The groping itself is his legacy and his challenge. Paul Tillich, a German Lutheran, 20 years Bonhoeffer's senior, lived to carry on the post-war inquiry in New York, and eventually here at Harvard, hence this memorial lecture series. Tillich had been dismissed from his Frankfurt teaching post by the Nazis, and he too found the crisis of Nazism at the center of his reflection. Like Bonhoeffer, he saw a consequent religionlessness as somehow necessary, but also as revelatory. Indeed, it formed the basis of his existentialist theology, which came to fruition in his post-war reflections, especially in the books The Courage to Be, published in 1952, and The Dynamics of Faith, published in 1957. Here, in slightly more abstract language, is Tillich's echo of what Bonhoeffer wrote in the letter to Bethge. Quote, "The relation of man to the ultimate, undergoes changes. Contents of ultimate concern vanish or are replaced by others. Symbols which for a certain period or in a certain place express the truth of faith for a certain group now only remind of the faith of the past. They have lost their truth, and it is an open question whether dead symbols can be revived. Probably not for those for whom they have died. The most important symbol that had lost its truth for Tillich was the primordial symbol of God, which after Hitler had been irrevocably undermined. In The Courage to Be, he wrote, God appears as the invincible tyrant, the being in contrast with whom all other beings are without freedom and subjectivity. He is equated with the recent tyrants who, with the help of terror, try to transform everything into a mere object, a thing among things, a cog in a machine they control. He becomes the model of everything against which existentialism revolted. This is the God Nietzsche said had to be killed, because nobody can tolerate being made into a mere object of absolute knowledge and absolute control. This is the deepest root of atheism. It is an atheism which is justified as the reaction against theological theism and its disturbing implications. Now, whether obsequies for religion or theological theism are a function of maturity is debatable, to say the least. Think of the 21st century phenomenon of so-called fundamentalism across religious borders, across the world. Yet Bonhoeffer's seemed an uncanny anticipation of Europe's broad post-war exodus from religion, with the resulting mass redundancy of church buildings and the muting of the voices of clergy. Today, apart from the hollow formalism of royalty-ruled churches in Britain and Scandinavia, institutional religion has entirely vacated the public realm of Europe, and in some places, the private conscience, too. Three-quarters of the once devout Czech Republic, to take only one example, are now religiously unaffiliated. I locate this question, though, first, not in such poll numbers or in philosophical debates, but in a deeply personal problem. Having myself imbued and learned to take for granted basic assumptions of the so-called secular age, what of my own religious inheritance can I believe without being dishonest? I am no fundamentalist, and the limits of religion, even its perversity, are fully apparent to me. If the faith continues to impose itself as a primal option, it does so in my case despite, or is it because of, the crises of 1945. What happens when traditional belief slams into the abyss of the Holocaust? What happens when it slams into the wall of Hiroshima? Here is my simple proposition. Even more than the challenges of secularity, or of, in Tillich's phrase, justified atheism, a Christian retrieval of the meaning of Jesus in the 21st century can be accomplished only by a much fuller reckoning with the famously necessary, if insufficient, cause of the Shoah, which was the long and coming catastrophe of Christian anti-Semitism. A widespread church refusal to reckon with an essential Christian failure about the Jews, for that matter, is, I hold, at least part of why the Spirit bled from mainstream Christian denominations in the decades since the failure showed itself. And it is why, I hold, the only form of Christian belief to actually grow in these years is a faith dedicated to the restoration of the very biblical literalism that put Christ-killer Jews at risk in the first place. The literalism on display across the globe 2 weeks ago in Holy Week. Let his blood be upon us and upon our children. Bonhoeffer's death row recognition was simple and may yet prove timeless. Quote, "An expulsion of the Jews from the West," he wrote, "must necessarily bring with it the expulsion of Christ. For Jesus Christ was a Jew." If Jesus were remembered across most of 2,000 years as the Jew he was, the history of those millennia and their climax in the crimes of the thousand-year Reich would be very different. But memory is uncertain. Jesus is elusive. If he were not, he would be useless to us. An ultimate paradox lies at the heart of Christian belief. Jesus is fully human. Jesus is fully divine. Best for me to say frankly right here at the outset of a post-Holocaust and, dare I say, post-modern attempt at retrieval, Jesus as God and Jesus as man are the brackets within which my inquiry must unfold. Jesus is fully divine. What can that mean now? Before dismissing such a claim, I announce a kind of cautionary declaration against which every assertion in this talk should be measured. If Jesus were not regarded as God, almost from the start of his movement, he would be of no interest to us. We would, in fact, never have heard of him. Nothing but his divinity accounts for his place in Western culture, or speaking personally, in my heart. Not his ethic, which was admirable, but hardly uncommon. Not his preaching, which was firmly in line with Jewish proclamation. Not his heroic suffering, which was typical of many anti-Roman Jewish resistors. Not his wonder-working, which was attributed to all kinds of charismatic figures in the ancient world. Nothing but a 2,000-year-old divinity claim puts Jesus before us today. And more, if a faith in Jesus as Son of God, a present self-disclosure of God's fatherly and forgiving disposition and incarnation, does not survive the critically minded, scientifically responsible, properly secular inquiry of the kind routinely undertaken at universities like this, then Jesus will surely drop back into the crowd of history's heroes, ultimately to be forgotten. The God-man affirmation, I hold, need not condemn this pursuit to irrationality or to absurdity, or to a separate, non-overlapping magisterium in Stephen Jay Gould's formulation, where the normal rules of logic need not apply. No, the normal rules of logic must apply here, too. The God-man affirmation can instead, I hold, sponsor a recovery of the light and depth and beauty of the Christian tradition at its best, even while offering a new way appropriate to a less credulous time to say that Jesus is Christ, that Jesus Christ is God. Speaking quite personally again, nothing matters more to me than that, and for no other reason would I have come before you tonight. Back to Tillich. We have problems believing that Jesus is God because we don't really know what the word God refers to. To renounce the divinity of Jesus, as a core of new Jesus scholars do, never mind the new atheists, is to attribute paradoxically some reality to divinity itself. Isn't it better to acknowledge an essential ignorance about what or who lies, as we say, beyond? The intuition that Jesus is the Christ, and therefore somehow of God, far from being the product of naivete or superstition, can be rooted in a profoundly sophisticated grasp of the meaning of existence. This is Tillich. It pushes past the boundaries of what is readily known and suggests that the realm, as we say, out there, is real. The atheist legal scholar Ronald Dworkin pointed out in a book published by Harvard Press, that the depth of awareness common to religion is a, quote, deep, distinct, comprehensive worldview. Religion holds that inherent objective values permeate everything, that the universe and its creatures are awe-inspiring, that human life has a purpose, and the universe order. A belief in a God is only one possible manifestation or consequence of that worldview. Belief in Jesus as making that God available is another. Yet all of this is necessarily cloaked in uncertainty. We recall Albert Einstein's assertion that humans have the capacity for grasping, quote, the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, but because we do the grasping with, quote, our dull faculties, we can perceive such transcendent mysteries only, quote, in their most primitive forms. Atheists and theists can, perhaps, meet one another in the field of limits, the limits of skepticism and the limits of faith. If they can agree to acknowledge such limits born of our dull faculties, and the limits for atheists and theists are parallel and even, yes, overlapping. Believers directly confront an ultimate mystery. All that we know for certain about God is that we do not know God. Here, for Christians, is the pointed relevance of Jesus Christ, for in Him we have the knowledge of God that matters. Only if we accommodate and protect some kind of belief in the divinity of Christ, as critically informed as it is true to the tradition, let's call it a postmodern faith, does Jesus Christ have a future as more than a misunderstood victim, a mere practitioner of the good deed, or perhaps as an avatar of rebellion, a zealot? The strongest argument, I do not say proof, in favor of Christ's divinity is not from biography, what unfolded the 30 years of his life, but from history, what believers have made of this figure across 2,000 years. Our perception here is decisive. For us, he is God. But when we assert, presumably with far less complication, that Jesus was a human being, is the matter really any clearer? What is a human being? We do not know with certainty what or who God is, but it is equally true, in fact, that we do not actually know what a human is. The inability to grasp the mystery of our own meaning as humans defines the contemporary crisis of identity more sharply than anything. God is not the problem. We are the problem to ourselves. We see now, through the insights of science and the traumas of political conflict, and the shorthand for both is 1945, that all of the traditional points of reference in relationship to which humans have understood themselves have been upended. Realities as basic as time and space are not the distinct realms they seem to be, any more than energy and matter are truly separate entities. We used to think that matter was the solid, unmovable ground of being, but now we know that matter is motion. Physics tells us that what we imagine to be solid is actually mostly emptiness within which waves fluctuate. And not just physics, metaphysics. Every universal truth is perceived from a particular perspective, which can seem to undercut universality. Our ideas are not what they were. All is flux, which humans have felt forever. But now, because of Kant and Einstein and Wittgenstein and their heirs, we see flux for what it is, everything. God is not fixed. Jesus is not fixed. We are not fixed. We humans can no longer take the measure of our world with anything like precision because the measures themselves are always changing. To be human, therefore, is to be on the way to becoming something else. And we can see this right now in front of our faces every time we hunch over a handheld smartphone or save a file to the cloud. A meta-world that exists everywhere and nowhere. What is the cloud? It may seem a stretch to find in suddenly ubiquitous but profoundly mundane technologies an image of world historic evolutionary mutation. But perhaps this is the way evolution has always worked, a secular process in which life's most sacred secret is embedded. The cloud is one of the new era's defining metaphors, but it carries implications of its own. clouds were an early emblem of heaven, the idealized afterlife where humans come into their reward. Indeed, it was on clouds that the Son of Man was to make his appearance the last day. And we know from the Talmudic scholar Daniel Boyron's work on the Gospels in the book of Daniel that the Son of Man coming on clouds was itself an early and profoundly Jewish assertion of the godliness of Jesus. "I am," said Jesus, we read in Mark, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." One problem, both with the ancient use of this cloud metaphor and with its adaptation today by a high-tech elevation of disembodied intelligence, is the way in which the insubstantial and immaterial cloud stands in contrast to the gritty earth, as if the destiny of human beings is to be freed from the bondage of the body, the physical brain designated as the meat computer, a technological Neoplatonism. But the cloud carries a wonderfully positive connotation too, with its invitation to value the mystery, paradox, and ambiguity that remain forever foreign to machines, an elevation of immateriality in a profoundly materialistic age. So the new and sudden, unexpected relevance of what an anonymous genius of the 14th century wrote, "The Cloud of Unknowing," in which the obscuring and elusive mist itself offered an image of breakthrough understanding, that awareness of life's ultimate unknowability, far from being mere ignorance, is the permanent precondition for the knowledge that makes us human. Quote, "For he can well be loved, but he cannot be thought." The author's "he" here is a word for God. But in this ingenious turn on the tradition, both he and God are words for the ineffable itself beyond words. Quote, "By love he can be grasped and held, but by thought neither grasped nor held. And therefore, though it may be good at times to think specifically of the kindness and excellence of God, and though this may be a light and a part of contemplation, all the same, in the work of contemplation itself, it must be cast down and covered with a cloud of forgetting, and you must step above it stoutly but deftly, with a devout and delightful stirring of love, and struggle to pierce that darkness above you, and beat on that thick cloud of unknowing with a sharp dart of longing love, and do not give up, whatever happens." This stepping above stoutly, deftly, can open into a realm of value and truth in which norms of certitude simply do not apply. Contemporary experience with social and technical mutations on the march is understandably threatening, but it can also be taken as an invitation to a far more spacious world, marked less by clinging than by letting go. The meaning of intelligence, of consciousness, and of self-consciousness is changing with every advance in technology, a process that continually surpasses expectation and is finally showing itself to be radically open-ended. And some version of this has been going on in the human story since the primeval ancestor chipped a stone into a tool. But in the scientific age, the pace of change has momentously accelerated, and so has human awareness of this staggering phenomenon. A new world, not so brave perhaps, yet still full of promise. Locating human meaning thoroughly within the evolutionary process anticipating transformations into heretofore unimagined and even post-human manifestations of intelligent being. All of this can seem to be the secular denigration of the human person that Galileo's inquisitors warned of. A reduction of the ancient image of man as the cosmic center and even pinnacle of God's creation. Against such a grand pre-Copernican conception, we humans must now be reckoned as mere accidents of natural selection, the random outcome of evolution, beings on the way to being something else. Humans are bits of straw blowing in the wind, in Blaise Pascal's image. Perhaps so. But with this one footnote, first provided by Pascal, humans are reeds of straw who think, reeds of straw who know, reeds of straw who choose, reeds of straw who willingly surpass themselves. We are responsible for evolution. The glory of man, more evident now than ever, is this built-in capacity for, and no other word will do, transcendence. For some, transcendence has a name. The phrase, the Son of Man, rooted as noted in the book of Daniel and amounting in the way applied to Jesus to an early and at least implicit claim to divinity, can also be translated as the human being, a thinly veiled suggestion that we all have the Son of Man's capacity for transcendence. Jesus Christ is the revelation of what awaits all human beings. The tension between his two titles, Son of Man and Son of God, is full of implication here. Jesus reveals humanity as much as he reveals divinity. Indeed, what Jesus, when taken to be Christ, reveals is that divinity abides not just in him, but in all of us. Here is where the traditional faith in Jesus Christ as Lord God, far from being outmoded in the secular age, meshes perfectly with the postmodern recognition of history's radical fluidity. The ancient Christian expectation of a future fulfilled in being taken up into God is wholly consonant with the dawning contemporary sense of an open-ended evolution ever surpassing itself. This is how we partake, in St. Peter's phrase, of the divine nature. The biblical tradition asserts that God is present with special focus in Israel and in Jesus. But first, God is present in creation. Of that holy presence, Israel is but the sign among the nations. Of that holy presence, Jesus Christ is the sacrament. But neither Israel nor Christ exhausts the presence of God in creation. The human person, not just Christ, is the creature in whom this mystery is revealed, because the human person participates in the life of creation and knows it. Thus, consciousness and self-consciousness, the unbounded scope of which were not fully grasped until the secular age, have come to be recognized as modes of the supreme consciousness known in the tradition as God, of whom we, yes, are the image. When we proclaim with the tradition that Jesus is Christ, that Jesus Christ is risen, that Jesus Christ is God, we know that we are not asserting scientific facts. We are offering interpretations of a bottomless mystery, ever to be plumbed, never mastered. And actually, Christian believers have always had language for this imprecise, ambiguous, unfinished faith. The Church has, despite appearances, never claimed to possess the whole truth about Jesus. For the memory of his having come is always paired with the expectation that he will come again in fulfillment of all human longing at the end of time. Parousia is a technical name for this expectation. Eschatology is another. Son of Man, we see again, is the name this culminating figure goes by. To expect him is to believe that history is headed somewhere, has an ultimate purpose which gives it present meaning. And the tradition of the second coming of Jesus, in fact, defines the fallible character of this peculiar faith, for it began in a misunderstanding. The first followers of Jesus, thinking of him in Jewish apocalyptic terms drawn from Daniel, thought he would return soon in messianic glory. St. Paul said the longed-for return would occur within the lifetimes of his readers. They were wrong. Still, the idea captured the essential truth of what Jesus promised, that the unfinished will be finished, ambiguities resolved, humanity will surpass itself in something more than humanity, a something that goes by the name of God. And this expectation, whether Christians remembered it or not, permanently rooted Christianity in Jewish messianic hope, where it remains, recovering that sense of Christian Jewishness, like recovering the permanent Jewishness not just of Jesus, but of Christ, defines the essential work that Christians must do after Auschwitz. Leaving us with a simple Jesus, an ordinary Christ, one whom the simplest person can imitate, the most ordinary person bringing Christ once more to life, day by day, word by word, bread by bread, cup by cup, in places like this. What Bonhoeffer called discipleship. Discipleship is a commitment to the memory and presence of Jesus Christ that makes a difference in how a life is lived, driving thought and behavior week in and week out. Thought, yes, as honed, informed, and critical as we can make it, which is the function of a place like this, but also behavior, what we call practice, measured against justice, compassion, and love. How do we reclaim Jesus as God? By behaving as if he is. In thought and practice both, alive to the memory of Jesus, we see divinity, which paradoxically is what makes Jesus one of us. Whatever sort of God Jesus is understood to be, it must be the God who is like humans, not different. If that seems impossible, then what we think of God and of humans must change. And the truest argument, finally, for the divinity of Christ, the divinity of Jesus, argument not proof, again, is in the one undenied fact of this history, that billions upon billions of ordinary human beings, not less smart than we, not more credulous, not less given to skepticism, that billions and billions of ordinary human beings in their thought, in their practice, have found in this faith an immediate and saving experience of the real presence of God, partaking of God, becoming God, even unto here and now, tonight. We come to Jesus in the end as in the beginning only through the Jesus people. The God to whom Jesus points is the God beyond God. We recognize in Jesus all that we need to know about the God who otherwise remains incomprehensible. And this recognition, because well-rooted in the past, is powerful enough to carry us into the open-ended future, even extending beyond what can be imagined. And can it be a surprise, after all of this, that one of the first to sense what is, after all, a necessary disenchantment with Christianity's anthropomorphic naivete was Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Whether he fully grasped the meaning of his intuition or not, we cannot miss the implication when we read today what he wrote in prison. The God who is with us is the God who forsakes us, the God who lets us live in the world without the working hypothesis of God, is the God before whom we stand continually. Before God and with God, we live without God. An intuition fulfilled in the wisdom of Paul Tillich, who makes us aware of the symbolic character of all of our religious affirmations. We know that as symbols, they are both true and untrue, which is what it is to live before God, without God. And we know that even the most precious of our symbols, including the divinity of Jesus, are invented. Our capacity for such invention itself points to the one who gave it to us. The Holy One who comes to us in the natural order, creation as the Creator's great self-communication, who comes to us in ordinary experience, which becomes extraordinary, becomes revelation, only through interpretation. Like this. Always offered as a way of saying, blessed are you, Lord God, Creator of the universe. Through your goodness, we have this way of coming home to faith and keeping it. Therefore, blessed are you.
We have a saying here at the Memorial Church, and that is that everyone may not belong to Mem Church, but Mem Church belongs to everyone. This is to say, what we do on Sunday morning may not be your cup of tea, but all through the week, we are a classroom of learning, a laboratory of learning and critical engagement. The type of events that you witness tonight. But more importantly, we are a community, and that means that we are codependent and interdependent upon one another. We affirm each other's humanity. And so therefore, we like to, at moments like this, we like to welcome you to join and embrace in community. And so therefore, James Carroll has agreed to, rather than Q&A, to sign some books in the memorial room, where we at the Memorial Church have established a wine and cheese reception for everyone, where we would ask that you would come and join us right now, where we can affirm each other's humanity, but more importantly, affirm the love of God as reflected in one another. Thank you all again for coming out, and please join me once again where he can hear us. And let's thank our tillich lecturer, James Carroll.